Hi, everyone, and welcome back to the Strike and Ellicott Files, an unofficial podcast dedicated to all things Cormoran Strike as written by Robert Galbraith. My name is Kenz, and today Lindsay, Bulls, and I will be discussing chapters 45 and 46 for our reread of Troubled Blood. As always, please be warned that our discussion of Troubled Blood will reference events that occur later in the book, as well as previous books in the series.
Are we talking about recent news first?
Yeah.
Because there's been some stuff, right?
There has been some stuff. It's been an exciting week.
It has been.
It has.
I feel like it's ramping up and that there have been a few of these lately. So I feel like something must be coming, right?
I hope so.
It's wishful thinking on my part.
I'll take it. I love the little things like this. It's fun.
Yeah, me too.
Because I freak out over every single one of them.
Yep. Like, oh, that just made my morning.
Yeah.
Let's get into what the tweet was that got us also excited.
Yeah.
So it goes, wish I had time to answer all of you, but Strike and Robin are at a tricky stage of their investigation, so I need to drop a few clues.
Ooh. I can't wait to miss all those clues.
Right? Oh, yeah. those clues are going to go so far over my head.
But the second and third time, I'm going to find them all.
Yeah, definitely. I like the tricky stage of their investigation.
Yeah, what does that mean? I was trying to think of all of the tricky stages in Troubled Blood that it could have been. Like chapter 20, right? Irene and Janice. Janice's second interview was tricky. Gloria was tricky. I don't know. You say things.
Well, I was hoping that their investigation was of each other's mouths. and that the tricky stage is the fact that they'll soon pass out from lack of air, but don't really want to stop the investigation. So
why would you not want to say that?
It seems like I have a one-track mind. You know, I want to be a nuanced, interesting commentator, but all I can think of is please let them kiss. I'm begging you.
Robin needs to investigate all the ways in which he's different from Matthew.
All of them.
Every single way. She needs to drop a few clues. So could that be at the end? Could she be writing the end of their investigation? I know I really want it to be at the end so we can read it. But you don't drop clues at the end, right? You figure out clues.
Well, I think there's some clues in Gloria Conti's interview.
Oh, yeah, there were clues.
And they were figuring things out after that. So I don't know. It could be anywhere. But it's exciting either way.
It is exciting.
Yeah. The other thing that the Rolling Library pointed out, and I noticed this too, but there is an extra space in between the word strike and Robin.
Huh.
So I don't know if she originally said something different and deleted it and put something else, or maybe it's just an extra space and we're making something of nothing because that's what we do.
Sometimes I do myself get a bit clumsy with the space bar. So I could see her doing that, but I could also see what could it, so it'd be, but strike is about to declare his eternal love. So I need to get a wiggle on with it. That would be nice. I'm a one track brain today.
Well, you're in good company.
Yeah. But it's good to know she's writing it, right?
Oh yeah, definitely. I don't really have any expectations for it being anything under than 2 years. So I kind of feel like another year is reasonable.
Yeah, we'll get there.
Maybe it'll follow the same trajectory as the last time we got a book announcement where she says she's done like around Christmas.
That would be cool. She could like tie in the I'm done with the Christmas pig stuff.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. When it comes out in October, it's just a few months away.
Oh, it's October.
October 12th.
I'm going to buy it even though I don't have kids.
Well, duh.
I want to own it. Well, you have 5-year-old.
Yeah, but he's not going to listen to a whole book, a whole chapter book. He's not going to listen to.
Fair enough.
I will read it.
I will read it too.
But no, yeah, it's already on pre-order. It's a done deal.
I should do that.
Did you guys listen to the interview yesterday with?
I did. Mm-hmm. The poet laureate?
Yeah, that was a great interview. It was really fun.
It was so good. She sounded relaxed and happy, and they had a really good conversation. I thought it was a great interview. I really enjoyed it.
There wasn't a ton on strike, although there was a little bit more in the extended version, if you listen to that.
I did listen to that one, yeah.
I loved when she talks about the locations and having, and that she doesn't have Wi-Fi in her writing room. So she has to go back to the kitchen to look up routes and locations.
I feel like I too would get more writing done if I turned off my Wi-Fi. I should maybe try that. But that's, yeah, I liked that. I liked it when she said that she loves her detective duo.
Yeah, that's my favorite.
We love them.
We
too.
All do. Same
we
joke.
We love them so much. What else was there?
I didn't know that she wrote The Cuckoo's Calling before The Casual Vacancy.
Yeah, that was new information, wasn't it?
Imagine it sitting there on the shelf for quite a while.
Oh, man.
She wished she had gotten away with it for longer, of not being outed as the author. Sorry, but I can't agree with you there.
No, I would never have read them if I hadn't known she wrote them, because it's not a genre I kept up on. So I'm, you know, it sucks for her, because I can get why she wanted to be anonymous, but I'm really glad I got to read them. Very much so.
Yeah, I'm really glad I still have one of like the earlier copies of Cuckoo, where it still says Robert Galbraith used to serve in the, you know, RMP, and he was an SIB and all this other kind of stuff. And it doesn't say anything about the fact that it's Joe yet.
Really? I don't think I have that.
Yeah. I don't know what mine says. I think I have an early edition too, but I lost the dust jacket ages ago.
I just know that I had to buy a new one because somebody borrowed it and never gave it back.
Okay, here is what it says. Robert Galbraith spent several years with the Royal Military Police before being attached to the SIB, Special Investigation Branch, the plainclothes division of the RMP. He left the military in 2003 and has been working since then in the civilian security industry. The idea for Cormoran Strike grew directly out of his own experiences and those of his military friends who returned to the civilian world. Robert Galbraith is a pseudonym.
Oh, what a liar. I love it. It's great.
Yeah, it is.
Okay, should we actually get into these chapters?
Yeah, I think so.
So we're going to start with chapter 45. And with this one, Robin goes to Leamington Spa, where she hopes that she's going to find contact information on Paul Satchwell. And there is a lot of introspection that goes on in this particular chapter, and it is awesome. For the epigraph for this one, it says, "Of ancient time there was a springing well from which fast trickled forth a silver flood full of great virtues and for medicine good."
On the surface, it's, you know, Robin's in Leamington Spa, and I know from Wikipedia that it's a town that became popular for its water and the idea that it had medicinal qualities. Mm-hmm. So that fits very well with the epigraph. But I'm also going to argue that the full of great virtues can also be tied in with Robin's thoughts on Strike and all of the things that she values about him, mm-hmm. loves.
So her subconscious is trickling forth, and it's actually good because it's full of good things, and it's going to be healthy for her to sort of start to think about these emotions. I could get behind that interpretation for sure.
Yeah,
absolutely.
This water isn't so much cleansing, or it's more like clarifying, I guess, because in this one, it brings a lot of clarity to how she feels about Strike. Mm-hmm. Might be a little bit of a stretch, but.
Because again, there's more water, but it's different from the water we've seen so far, which is storms and floods and dangerous waters with monsters lurking. This is
a gentle water.
It brings great virtues and good medicine. It feels like it represents life and hope.
Mm-hmm. And healing. Yeah, I like that. It's a nice epigraph.
It is. The opening line of chapter 45 says, "Robin was still at the office when Strike called that evening with the news that Joan had died."
God. Going right into it.
Right into it. She conveniently doesn't tell him that she's still at the office, how overworked she is, how tired she is. I think it's just later in this chapter that she falls asleep driving, right?
Yes.
Which was scary. Oh my God.
He would be so upset if he knew she'd fallen asleep behind the wheel, and so worried. That's why she didn't tell him, because she doesn't want him to worry. She doesn't want to add to his burdens. She wants to take care of it.
And later says that she increased her caffeine consumption to stay awake, made her slightly jittery, and she found it hard to sleep, even on the rare occasions the chance presented itself.
That's relatable.
Welcome to the past decade of my life, Robin. You weren't on constant caffeine drip at this point?
I guess the point is that she's
an angel, a literal angel on earth, the most lovable character who's ever been written.
The other touching bit is just seeing Strike honoring Joan's wishes. Because that couldn't have been easy, telling Ted and Lucy, especially because it says it reduced them both to sobs.
Yeah, that must have been painful.
I mean, Ted's tears.
Rip my heart out.
Ted's tears were for the poignancy of his wife making arrangements for his own comfort and relief, as she had done for the 50 years of their marriage, and for the news that she'd wanted, at the end, to enter the sea and wait for him there.
Oh, God. that hits hard.
I want to know everything about Ted and Joan, how they met, how they fell in love.
I feel like we might get more backstory on Ted and Joan in the course of getting more backstory on Lita.
Yeah.
Because I do feel like there was something going on with Lita and Ted's family and father.
Oh, definitely. Like why she wanted to change her name so badly.
Why Ted ran away to the military. Mm-hmm. Why they don't appear to be anywhere.
Right. Everything.
Yeah. Why does Cormoran not have any grandparents? Why has he never had any? So I feel like we might get more of that backstory in the next book.
I hope and I suspect that this is the type of love that Cormoran and Robin are headed for, and I can't wait to read about it.
Yeah.
Yes.
Absolutely.
50 years together. Oh my God. Like, that's incredible.
All of the people who say that it won't be as interesting once they get together, I just don't understand that perspective at all.
I don't get it either. I don't get it at all.
I can't wait to read about it.
There is so much to write about and to experience in a relationship. Like,
I know, it's baffling, right? I don't understand it either. I
would be so excited to read about them eventually being married detectives. I would be excited to read about them in a nursing home together, solving who stole the pudding from the pudding fridge. Like, I want to read it all.
That would be a case that Strike would be very interested in.
Strike would be very interested in, because he had his name on that goddamn pudding. But no, relationships adds a whole new dimension to the challenges that they face together and between each other. Hopefully not too much. But there will be some conflict. Of course. You get to see them continue to grow together rather than having to be perfect before they get together, which I think is ridiculous because J.K. Rowling is writing real people. Real people aren't perfect when they get together or even afterwards, you know. They continue to have flaws and they continue to work together to be together despite them. And to grow as people.
Yeah. And seeing how their relationship challenges tie into the cases and stuff, since she likes to do that, that'll
she
be cool.
She loves to do that. That will be cool.
Let's move on to Lucy's tears, though, because these are interesting, right? It says, in Lucy's case, the sobs were for the lost possibility of a grave she'd hoped to visit and tend. Lucy filled her days with voluntary obligations. They gave purpose and form to a life she was determined would never be like her flighty biological mother's.
Interesting phrasing there at the
end. It is, because I've never heard Lita referred to as her biological mother before. And I did a bit of a search in the ebooks and I couldn't find it anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I feel like it's probably put there to remind us that she feels like she's just lost her mother.
Yeah. And that is sad, and you do feel for her. We've seen moments, I think, I don't know if this is relevant, but we've seen Lucy remind Cormoran strongly of Joan, even though they're not related. And I think that maybe she aspired to be like Joan as a sort of role model, just like Corm did. So this, for her, it's like Corm losing Uncle Ted.
Yeah.
She's losing her mother, and she's losing the woman she looked up to and she tried her hardest to be like. It is hard, but these tears are a bit making it all about her, isn't it?
I'm sure that she's put a lot of thought already into tending this grave and that this is how she's going to show her love and her grief. Mm-hmm. But now that's being taken away. And it's just, exactly what you said. It's kind of making it about her and not what Joan wanted.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I can see her hurt. I can understand her hurt. And grief shows up in weird ways. It's not always perfect, selfless grief. Sometimes it is selfish. I do feel for her. I was just wondering if Lucy actually said that she was missing the grave, or if Strike sort of just assumed that she was crying because of that.
I had wondered that too, but I did remember later on, and I looked it up in chapter 52. It says, again and again, she returned to her sadness at not having a grave to visit, and Strike detected an undertone of blame, as though she thought Strike ought to have overruled Joan's dying wishes.
Ah, I see.
So she did say it out loud. She probably said it out loud quite a bit.
Yeah. So then, I think it's really cute when Strike tells Robin about this argument he's refereeing, where Ted wants people to send donations to the Macmillan Cancer Support, but Lucy wants people to send flowers because it's what Joan would have wanted.
So she does care what Joan wants occasionally, if it doesn't go against her own expectations.
Yes. So if other people's wants align with hers, then that's fine. But if they don't, they need to be changed. Oh, no. I've just realized I do that sometimes too.
Oh no, are you Lucy?
I am not Lucy, I'm just a control freak. Sometimes.
Well,
a little bit.
when Strike says that Lucy was right, Joan would have wanted flowers, as many as possible. That's how she always judged other people's funerals.
I love that.
I didn't know other people's funerals were a thing that you judged, but okay. Like, judged how much they'd be missed.
She's like, oh gosh, she didn't get very many flowers. I wonder why people didn't like her.
Yikes.
That's funny.
But it's sweet that Strike knew that she would like flowers and that he'd apparently heard her judge other people's funerals before.
It's kind of like how she always gossips to him, the local gossip, right?
Oh, yeah, the health of everyone in St. Maw's.
And this isn't really significant, but it did remind me, and I looked up the bit in Cuckoo's Calling where it reflects back to them sitting at the kitchen table crying over Leda. I don't know, I just imagine it being the same table.
Oh, God, yeah, the same table.
Ouch.
I'm just still worried about Ted's welfare in the next book. I don't know, that they'll be sitting at that table again.
Oh, come on.
Oh,
I really liked that he kept Robin on the phone so that he could tell her all the family drama and vent to her about it.
When I first read this, I was surprised that they were still on the phone. I hadn't realized that he was telling her all of this stuff.
Yeah, it's really nice. It reminded me a bit of the beginning of the book where he like voluntarily told her about the argument he had with Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe he's just more ready to vent about Lucy. Maybe that's not as off limits as other personal topics have been with him, but it was still sweet.
The next part after they get off the phone, though, it goes, after they'd bidden each other goodbye, Robin sat for a while at the partner's desk, wondering whether it would be appropriate for the agent to send flowers to Strike's aunt's funeral. She'd never met Joan. She wondered whether it would seem odd or intrusive to send condolences. She remembered how when she offered to pick Strike up from Joan's house in St. Maw's the previous summer, he'd quickly cut her off, erecting, as ever, a firm boundary between Robin and his personal life.
I like this place right here. We had just seen him opening up and then her remembering back to him kind of closing it off there. So I don't know, it's kind of showing how far they've come so far.
Yeah, I found it a bit odd that she was actually worried about this. They're literal business partners. They run an agency together. They've been working together for like almost 5 years at this point. But I thought it sort of showed just the extent to which he kept himself closed off. For her to be worrying about this now, he has been really closed off and set those boundaries firmly. And yeah, he might be starting to break them down, but it's going to take time for her to get used to them being broken down, right? And to not feel like she's overstepping.
Yeah, I don't know if I ever thought of it as odd.
No.
No,
definitely not.
But I'm glad she sent them, especially considering that we've just heard how much Joan would want all the flowers.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
At the outer door, she stopped, her reflection blank-faced in the dark glass. Then, as though responding to an unheard command, she returned to the inner office, switched the computer back on, and, before she could second-guess herself, ordered a sheaf of dark pink roses to be delivered to St. Maw's Church on March the 3rd with the message, "With deepest sympathy from Robin, Sam, Andy, Saul, and Pat."
I'm probably reading too much into this, but the fact that she stops and looks at her own reflection gives me this sense of kind of seeing the truth reflected back at you. So this unheard command feels like the part of her that she keeps hidden, and it's revealing itself in her reflection. That part that wants to reach out to him, that wants a deeper connection with him. I feel like it kind of looks her in the face, and that's what draws her back to order the flowers.
I love that.
Yeah, me too. And it's funny because it ends up meaning so much to him later.
And speaking of overanalyzing things, these dark pink roses.
Yeah.
I went on a bit of a Google hunt for flower color meanings. I was a little underwhelmed at first by what I was finding because everything for pink flowers was saying that it represents gratitude and it's a nice way to say thank you.
Thank you to Joan for raising such a wonderful man for her to spend her life with.
Okay, well, there you go.
Sorry, that just popped into my mind as the first interpretation.
It's great. But I found this really nice explanation on Reader's Digest, actually. And it says, when it comes to pink roses, all the shades have something in common. They symbolize gratitude, grace, and joy, and they're a much gentler option than red. For example, while red signifies passionate love, think of pink as more of a token of admiration. In terms of which pink to choose, when you want to tell your best friend how thankful you are for the bond you share, deep pink roses are a fantastic choice.
Oh, that's lovely.
Aww.
While I hope that we soon get to the red roses passionate love,
this
is perfect for where they are right now.
That is really sweet. I've just realized that they both give flowers in this book.
Yeah.
Right. Robin's are
with varying appropriate degrees of success.
And touching and exactly right. And Strike's are literally the opposite of that. They could not be more wrong, insulting, and unwanted. So that's a neat bit of symmetry from the beginning of the book to after this turning point, the change in the appropriateness of the gifted flowers. So then we move on to talk about work.
Yeah, Robin's killing it.
Mm-hmm. Of course she's killing it. She's amazing. She's fantastic.
She wraps that postcard. And how obnoxious is the weatherman here? I mean, he's disappointed that his stalker isn't more attractive.
Right. And he's been such a shit about it kind of the whole time. Because earlier, like, his wife was suggesting, oh, well, it might be a guy that's stalking you.
He's very much enjoying the attention. I wouldn't be surprised if his wife is the one who made him contact the agency in the first place.
Oh, I believe it. Yeah. I would believe this guy's got a bit of an ego and was happy imagining some beautiful young thing obsessed with him sending him postcards. The commodities broker.
The next client. This woman is disappointed that she didn't get to meet Strike. And, you know.
Same.
Who can blame her, really?
But maybe this is why she doesn't like her initially.
Of course it's why. Robin is so jealous. Mm-hmm. She has been possessive of Strike for a long time, and she does not like other women being interested in him.
Yeah.
Or even worse, him being interested in them. Oh. It's cute. She doesn't realize it, really.
Mm-hmm. Cue that song from Hercules.
Yeah. I don't think we're allowed to sing it, because copyright? You all know the song we're talking about, though. But it's nice that she starts off not liking her, but then she does feel a bit of sympathy.
Yeah, because she thinks of Matthew, and it's one of those moments that I wonder if she looks at her and thinks, this could have been me if I stayed.
Oh, thank God she didn't. 14 years?
Oh, yeah. Ooh,
I couldn't handle 1 year that was glossed over in a time skip.
And I'm really sorry to do this to you, Pools, but I have to talk about Morris.
Do we? Do we have to?
I just really want to know what your thoughts are on him wanting to call her RB for rich bitch.
My thoughts are that I hate him. I want to punch him in the face. He is so disrespectful and so misogynistic, and he's not even bothering to hide it. And I think that's what annoys me most, that he's being so unprofessional about it. How is that appropriate for an office setting?
Much less to somebody who's your boss.
Yeah, but he doesn't think of her as his boss.
He doesn't. Does nope. he? And this is just more evidence.
That makes it even worse.
The whole thing when he says, like, oh, feminist alert, that's what annoys me.
Oh, yeah.
A lot. Because you know that for a man like Morris, that's a bad word.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Oh, no. You're not one of those hairy, man-hating feminists, are you? I might not be into you, Robin. You don't want to be a feminist.
Do you promise? She's thinking.
Please. If I say I'm a feminist, will you leave me alone? God. Ugh, I hate him so much.
That reminds me of that line from later about the, you know, what would it take for you to walk away from a blind date? And Robin's like, you showing up.
Makes me laugh. I so wish she'd said that out loud.
Robin trails the nanny for a bit. And do either of you guys have any thoughts on the fact that the nanny reminded Robin of Lorelai? I think it's mentioned twice in this chapter.
I mean, other than the fact that Strike's exes live in her head rent-free.
Exactly. God, subconscious jealousy all over the place.
Bless her.
There's this line here, the commodities broker's children certainly seemed to adore their nanny, and so Robin feared did their father. While he didn't once touch the nanny in any amorous way, he showed every sign of a man completely smitten, mirroring her body language, laughing excessively at her jokes, and hurrying to open doors and gates for her.
I want to pay attention to see if Strike mirrors Robin's body language at any point in the rest of this book, because that's not something I paid attention to.
That's exactly why I put this in the notes, because... He does open the door for her.
He does.
He does. I want Robin to pay attention to these things, too.
Somehow, I feel that for some reason, she's going to be able to explain away all of these things when Strike does them.
But when this guy does it.
She can see it when this guy does it, but I feel like she's going to be more second-guessing when Strike does. But I just make a note, you guys, that I need to be paying attention to Strike mirroring her body language. He already laughs at her jokes, but that's because she's hilarious. Everyone laughs at her jokes.
And he opens the door for her, so we'll watch for the other one.
Yeah, the body language, though, that's the smitten. I'm going to be paying attention to that. Mark it down.
Yeah, that definitely jumped out to me the first time that I was reading it was, ooh, I wonder if we're going to see that in the future.
Ooh. Let's get to the heart of the chapter when Robin heads to Leamington Spa.
Yes.
She thinks about money. Mm-hmm. And how they're both on the same page with carefully spending the agency's money.
Yeah. I feel like he'd be more willing to spend the money on her comfort than his own.
Mm-hmm.
But he would have absolutely told her. And he told her at the beginning of...
Right, he did.
No driving, no sleeping in the car, which makes me wonder if she slept in the car before.
This is just something I want to blame on Matthew for how he was with money.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense. I was just thinking it was it's like Robin living up to the Yorkshire stereotype, which is that they're a bit tight with money.
Is that a thing?
Yeah, it's a thing.
I don't know anything about that. I just want to blame Matthew.
Yeah, let's blame Matthew.
Okay, it's done. It is a good idea for her to look around and see if this was a possible place that Margo was, because right. She was spotted there.
Yeah.
So yeah, it is a good idea.
It makes sense to me.
And you know what else is a good idea? Indulging in little fantasies.
Ooh.
This is one of my favorite parts.
I am always ready to indulge in a little fantasy, yes.
A little strike fantasy.
Please tell me her fantasy. I just want to hear you read it.
Go ahead, Kins.
For a moment or two, she indulged herself in a little fantasy of flying out to Greece with Strike to interrogate the old artist. She imagined the oven blast of heat that would hit them on leaving the plane in Athens and saw herself in a dress and sandals heading up a dusty track to Satchwell's front door. But when her imagination showed her Strike in shorts, with the metal rod of his prosthetic leg on display, she felt suddenly embarrassed by her own imaginings and closed the little fantasy down before it took her to the beach or to the hotel.
Aww. He shuts it down right before it gets good.
I know. Robin has some amazing self-control to shut that fantasy down. My brain does what it wants. I can't control it. Like, that fantasy would have been getting me through the entire 2-hour drive.
I remember reading it like, no, please don't shut it down.
Don't shut it. Get to the hotel, Robin. Tell us about the hotel. Is it a little B&B with whitewashed walls and bougainvilleas trailing over the doors? Do you have dinner at a little cafe by the seaside? And laugh over your wine? Like, tell me more. Sorry, now I'm indulging in some fantasies.
Speaking of that, Strike and Robin are going to need to go to Greece together at some point now in the future. It has to happen. Make it happen.
I don't even care if it's actually Greece. I just want another trip.
Yeah, I want them to be alone together for an extended period of time. I don't care where the hell it is. They can go... What's less romantic than Skegness or Barrow Inverness in the UK? Milton Keynes? British people, please chime in. What is a less romantic city than the two they've already been to? Can we get less romantic?
And Barrow?
That's hard. Barrow's pretty unromantic.
I think you guys can do it. I just realized she's been to Greece with Matthew, hasn't she?
Mm-hmm.
So she's putting this sort of little, it's a romantic fantasy because she took a romantic trip there before, right? That's a bit of a reach, I admit.
I mean, come on, that's where she's going.
Yeah, it made me sad that she was embarrassed, so.
A little sad, but it's also like her respect for his boundaries are such that she gets embarrassed because he's never really shown that to her. So,
yeah.
Like, he would not be comfortable with this. Yeah.
Yeah, that is really sweet. She's imagining more of Strike than he's been willing to display, and she feels so respectful that she's. I wonder if he is as respectful of her in his own fantasies. That's something that I'm really curious about and that I hope Joe goes into detail about in the next book, because I want to know what kind of fantasies he's having.
For science.
Just for science. Yeah. For comparison.
I feel like we could talk about this for a long time.
Them together in Greece having a good old romantic time. Yeah.
Robin arrives in Leamington Spa and she's wondering why Margo would have visited the cemetery church in the first place. And obviously...
Dun, dun, dun.
She didn't. But the end of the paragraph says the missing doctor was becoming very real to Robin.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if part of the reason that Margot feels so real to us as readers is because Robin uses aspects of Margot's life to make sense of her own, and she grows from it in a way that Margot never got the chance to.
Yeah, there's a reason why J.K. Rowling wrote it so that Margot died at age 29. Because that's the exact same age that Robin is for this book. And even though their lives are different, there were some similarities and there were some parallels in them. And I totally agree. I'm having feelings about it because what we learn of Margot, I love her. I want to be best friends with her. And I'm really, really sad that she never got the chance to keep growing. Like Robin's getting that chance. And I just feel so happy for Robin that she's living her life the way she wants to. And I'm having emotions about it that I didn't sign up for. This is supposed to be a happy, cute chapter.
I just want to real quick plug these location pages on Strike Fans because these were a lot of fun to do.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're so much fun when they kind of walk around. I love being able to follow the exact trail that they follow, and these ones were fun. I actually, you know, when she's standing in front of the two graves and she Googles information about it, I'm pretty sure I found like the exact same page that she Googled. Neat. So I'll drop a link in the show notes, but yeah, that stuff is fun.
So this is a clue, right? The fact that there are no actual graves to look at is a clue that Janice made this whole thing up, right?
Well, there's two, but yeah, it's not a cemetery.
It's not a cemetery, really. And that is sort of a red flag that Janice mm-hmm. was talking nonsense.
Yeah, it's a bit of a, there's something not quite right with this.
Yeah, because I looked up in the end of the book and she says later that Ramage told her about seeing another missing woman in a country churchyard. And she transplanted that story to Leamington Spa without realizing there weren't graves to look at there except for just mm-hmm. these two. So clue flag, it's a clue.
Yeah.
Oh, we're getting to the good bit now.
We're getting to the good bit. Robin goes into the pub.
There is just too much good stuff in this bit. Summarize it for us, Lindsay.
Well, let's just start with the beginning, that a couple men walk in and one of them is tall and broad and has curly hair and sparks.
Oh,
so cute.
This bit, it just makes me so excited, especially when I first read it, because these are reactions that she can't control, right? We're mm-hmm. used to seeing her keeping everything hidden, everything buried, and this thrill of excitement and happiness that passed through her, the sparks in the pit of her stomach turning red. These are all physical reactions that are harder to ignore and dismiss. And I want these to happen more in the next book so yes. that she can't hide it. She can't deny it.
And here's another instance of that blushing that mm-hmm. I think the troubled blood is showing in her face.
Yeah. The other reactions that she has are just waves of shame for
Poor
feeling
girl.
It.
Thing.
Why?
Well, is it because she's denying these feelings for so long? Is she afraid of them? Mm-hmm. She works so hard to keep them hidden.
Yeah, she tends to have these really visceral reactions to things like that. Because, you know, whenever she called Strike in Lethal White after her wedding and mm-hmm. she caught Coco on the phone, that's described as it being like a hard slap in the face.
Yeah, I mean, all of that, the shame of feeling these things. Maybe it's shame because admitting she feels them would mean admitting how long she's been feeling them.
Yeah.
Once she's opened up that can of worms, it's like she's not just going to be able to say, oh, you know, I kind of like him, I guess. No.
Yeah. I think that maybe there's a part of her that doesn't think Strike feels the same way or isn't sure. I don't think she's certain. I know she says that there are moments when she thinks he thought of her as a woman, but I think she's by no means secure that he could feel anything to her or does feel anything for her. And so that maybe she feels she's being appropriate when she should be being professional, because being professional is a pretty big thing for her. Mm. And developing feelings for your business partner that aren't reciprocated is not very professional and a bit of a disaster, even though we know they are reciprocated.
Right. This line says, Robin knew she'd been avoiding the question of what she really felt about Strike for the past year. I'm going to skip a little bit.
Yeah.
It had been easy not to think about anything else, even a question as fraught as what she really felt for Cormoran Strike.
Drumroll, what does she feel? Is she about to tell us?
I remember reading it and just like gripping the book, like, is she going to say it?
Is she going to say it? I mean, yes. And that one song from Hercules continues to play in the background because mm-hmm. it is her song in this chapter.
It really is.
At least out loud, she won't say.
But notice that she does go from wondering this to then immediately remembering when she was asking herself if she was in love with him.
Yeah. For some reason. Ask yourself if you're in love with someone.
You probably are.
She liked her partner. She admired him. She was grateful to him. That was it. That was all. Except she remembered how much pleasure it had given her to see him sitting in Notes Cafe after a week's absence, and how happy she was, no matter the circumstances, to see Strike's name light up her phone.
I cannot with this bit. I cannot with her. She is ridiculous.
She's got it bad.
The word accept is just the greatest word.
Accept, dot, dot, dot.
Something that I really liked whenever I was re-listening to this audiobook part is, oh my goodness, this whole inner monologue that Robin has about her feelings for Strike. What could they be? Nobody knows. This part especially, There are enough pregnant pauses in this internal monologue to fill a fucking nursery. Oh my god. It is ridiculous. That except is a particularly good one.
Yeah.
And I love the callback to the Notes Cafe, because that was such a great chapter. And it's the first time that she really acknowledges this kind of physical attraction to him with the wave of liking simply for the way he looked. Mm-hmm. And here's one of the first times we're seeing these physical reactions from her, the redness, the sparks in her stomach, you know, it's great.
I'm having a moment over here. She's so in love.
She is. And just, you know, Strike's name lighting up her phone.
I like that no matter the circumstances, even when she's absolutely furious with him, as we saw. Yeah. And then she goes on. There's more.
There is more.
There's so much more. This is such a gift of a chapter.
It is. Thank you, Joe.
Yes, thank you for giving us this precious gift.
That we've been waiting for since Career of Evil.
Yeah.
But we'll get to that in a minute, yeah.
The next one says, almost scared now, she forced herself to think about how bloody aggravating Strike could be. Grumpy, taciturn, and ungrateful. And nowhere near as handsome, with his broken nose and hair that he himself has described as pube-like, as Matthew or even Morris.
She hates Morris. Why is she? She is really desperate if she's throwing Morris in there to not acknowledge that she's in love with Strike.
It's a pretty sad list.
Yeah. Grumpy, taciturn, and ungrateful. I mean, yeah, okay.
It just makes me laugh that she's trying to talk herself out of this.
And he's not even handsome.
And yet she just acknowledged she likes the way he looks.
Mm-hmm. I'll continue with this, ready? But he was her best friend. The admission, held at bay for so long, caused an almost painful twist in Robin's heart, not least because she knew it would be impossible ever to tell Strike so. She could just imagine him lumbering away from her like a startled bison at such a naked statement of affection, redoubling the barriers he liked to erect if ever they got too close to each other.
Oh my god. So in 13 chapters from now, he's going to tear down that wall himself. And I'm so excited about that.
It makes it so much better that he's the one who says it first.
It really does. It really does.
Also, can we have a moment of appreciation for the startled bison line? Because I think that's one of my favorite comparisons.
That's one of the best lines of the book. The image of him lumbering away like a startled bison is absolute perfection.
The bison emoji on my phone is used now because of how much I send it to you, Ken. That and the bear.
Yes. Oh my god, the bear.
Bison, bear.
And this next bit where it says, nevertheless, there was a kind of relief in admitting the painful truth. She cared deeply for her partner.
Oh, relief in admitting the painful truth.
Yeah, let's admit more truth, Robin, because it's not the full truth.
Yeah, this isn't even close to the full truth. And I think she knows it deep down. Just say it. I'm like, say it. Say it, Robin.
No chance.
No way. I won't say it. Uh-oh. Cue the Disney lawyers. We got to go into hiding now. Mickey Mouse is coming for me.
This next bit is really awesome, where she's talking about her favorite parts of his personality. This is so sweet.
It's a much longer list, isn't it?
It is. It's a much better list.
She trusted him on the big things, to do the right thing for the right reasons. She admired his brains and appreciated his doggedness, not to mention the self-discipline, all the more admirable because many whole-bodied men had never mastered it. She was often astonished by his almost total lack of self-pity. She loved the drive for justice that she shared, that unbreakable determination to settle and to solve.
I love this part. I don't think I need to explain to you guys.
No.
How much I love this, because these are all of the things that I love about him as a character. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And she's saying, yes, you're right. These are all the great things about him.
Yeah. They're the important things.
Yeah. I think that there are some people, some fans, who maybe focus on the other things, the grumpiness, right? Mm-hmm. His imperfections, and don't see these things that are really important and make up who he is and why he is a good man. And these are the things that really matter. And so I'm really glad that Robin had this moment, because I feel justified in my feelings how I feel about him as a character.
They really share some essential values, don't they? And I think that's incredibly important in a strong relationship, is having the same values.
Which is a big contrast with her and Matthew.
Yeah.
Right.
No values.
Night and day.
No shared values there. Absolutely none.
Yeah, and like we were saying before, this is a much better list compared to the other one. These are the things that matter, the values that they share. These are the things that makes him a good man. Like, so what if he's grumpy? She trusts this man. It feels significant that this comes right after Joan telling him that he was a good man in the last chapter, because Joan says it, but then here we have Robin reflecting on all the reasons why that's true.
And when Joan told him, he was like, well, I don't know about that. Mm-hmm. And then we have Robin affirming it to herself. Oh, I want her to tell. So I want her to tell him what a good man she thinks he is, even if he's very aggravating at times.
Killing me.
Rest in peace.
R.I.P. Lindsay. Now I'm the only Lindsay.
I gotta go.
And then she continues with, I love this, that he's never made her feel physically uncomfortable, which is
so important.
Great. Yeah. Yeah.
I love particularly in this bit where she's describing, especially in the past, Fools, you were talking about the things that Robin has to do, you know, to kind of navigate around her trauma and keep herself safe and comfortable and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just, the way that she describes like that feeling of shrinking within your skin when men that you don't want, that are, you're totally not interested in, look at you and it's lechy and weird. The way that she describes that, it was just so great. I could feel that as I was.
Oh, yeah.
As I was reading it.
I think we've all experienced that, like the touching of your lower back to help you walk. Like we need help walking.
Yeah. The ostensibly helpful touch.
I'm very bad at walking.
But no, the point is we don't need men. We don't want touching us to help us walk.
Exactly. Yes.
One more thing that I wanted to bring up, just because we're talking about, you know, the relationship trajectory and how they're going to kind of navigate around these things in the future, is how exactly they're going to push their relationship forward into another space. How is he supposed to, because Strike is so,
I think it'll be her,
of Robin's boundaries. Yeah, either Robin is going to have to make the first physical move, or.
Well, I mean, and she does at the end, right? She's the one who hugs him and kisses him on the cheek. She's the one who does that. I expect it'll be her, but I don't know.
I think Strike has the ability to read her and would be able to tell. If she was like, he can read body language and knows if she's welcoming a touch. We've all imagined this happening a million different ways.
Yeah, of course. The next bit says, in truth, why not admit everything to herself now? When she was so tired, her defenses lowered. She was aware of only 2 moments in 4 years where she'd been sure that Strike had seen her as a desirable woman, not as a friend or an apprentice or a younger sister. It's so funny. That is not how he sees her. Not
I wish I could see inside his head, because, oh boy. Yeah, so those 2 moments.
Right, the dress.
It made her feel happy and flattered that he got that for her. That's cute.
That is really cute. Yeah, that she had looked wonderful in the dress and he wanted her to know. Wait, he talks about the dress in chapter 58, doesn't he? Or was that in an earlier chapter?
He says it's in an earlier chapter. You look gorgeous in this and I wanted you to know it. Yeah.
And that is exactly what she'd wondered whether he was trying to convey, right? Mm-hmm. That's the exact same thing, that she'd looked wonderful in the dress. So his gorgeous message got through loud and clear.
Gorgeous.
And it made her gorgeous. Gorgeous. His message got through loud and clear, and it made her feel happy and flattered. And I love it.
But this next bit, oh my God. It kills me every time. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Sorry if that was really loud. I'm really excited about this. And y'all know what my favorite part of this bit is. Okay. The second moment, far more painful to remember, had been when she'd stood at the top of the stairs at her wedding venue, Strike below her, and he'd turned when she called his name and looked up at her, the new bride. He'd been injured and exhausted, and again, she'd seen a flicker of something in his face that wasn't mere friendship, and they'd hugged, and she'd felt best not to think about it, best not to dwell on that hug, on how like home it felt, on how a kind of insanity had gripped her at that moment, and she'd imagined him saying, come with me, and known she'd have gone if he had.
Oh my God.
Doesn't that kind of answer the question for you, Robin? How at home it had felt, knowing you'd run away with him?
The fact that they are both thinking about a single hug constantly.
That was one... Right? Hell of a hug.
3 years later, they're still thinking about this hug. First of all, they're ridiculous. Second of all, this is such a Kairos moment for them. And I want an acknowledgement that it's a Kairos moment. like we got about Charlotte in book one. This beats that. Mm-hmm. It's the telling moment, the supreme moment. But yeah, so that list of two moments. I have a feeling that by the end of the book six, this little list is going to be a lot longer.
Let us hope.
I hope so.
I'm very much hoping.
Here's where I want to explain why I said that I've been waiting for this since Career of Evil.
Okay.
Okay. Because Kenz, you and I in our Twitter reread last year, we talked about this a lot. Mm-hmm. We wanted for Troubled Blood a Robin version of chapter 40 of Career of Evil, which for people who don't remember was Strike thinking about for the first time his feelings about Robin.
And how deep they run.
Yes. So we talked so much about how we wanted this chapter. And I remember reading it and being like, oh my God, did we just get it? Did we get what we wanted?
Yes.
And I'm going to say, this is not just a coincidence, like it's kind of similar. I have some...
She has receipts.
I went back and reread chapter 40 of Career of Evil the other day. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to go ahead and say that Joe just had the chapter open and was using it for reference.
I love that.
Because, okay, the first quote, he says, yet he liked her face, he liked her voice, he liked being around her. That yet feels very much like
the accept. Yeah, yes. That we just talked about. It's the same structure too. Three short sentences, internal parallelism.
Very similar. I mean, some of these have even the same wording.
Yeah, the sentence structure is killing me. She liked her partner. She admired him. She was grateful to him. He liked her face. He liked her voice. He liked being around her. They are mm-hmm. both short staccato sentences with this parallelism. And there's three of them. And it's just perfect. Sorry. I just can't get over how perfectly those two match up.
There's more. Is if I'm going to be honest moment. So in Career of Evil, it says in parentheses, if he was going to be honest with himself, he should do it thoroughly. In Troubled Blood, it says, in truth, in parentheses, why not admit everything to herself now when she was so tired, her defenses lowered? Similar again.
Yep.
They both talk about the other's physical appearances. So in Career of Evil, Strike thinks that Robin isn't as beautiful as Charlotte. Mm-hmm. In Troubled Blood, she thinks Strike isn't nearly as handsome as Matthew or Morris.
Yeah.
They both make a list of cons. Which is funny, right? Strike's list says, almost angrily, he added together those things he knew and had observed that marked her as profoundly different from him. And then Robin starts with, in Troubled Blood, almost scared now, she forced herself to think about how bloody aggravating Strike could be. So they both start with the word almost. Almost angrily, almost scared.
They are both really trying to talk themselves out of being in love, aren't they? And they're not doing a great job at
No,
it.
They're not.
Dummies.
Uses are so flimsy, like especially with Strike's, because what is it that she's middle class and had a pony?
She had a pony. Oh, okay, Strike. I'm pretty sure Charlotte had ponies too.
I know. I was thinking the same thing.
Ridiculous.
There's still more.
Yeah.
They both have a that was all moment. So Strike thinks that she's just making a huge mistake. That's all. That was all. It wasn't personal. And Robin, she liked her partner. She admired him. She was grateful to him. That was it. That was all.
Yeah, that's definitely all.
And I think the last one is just that they both reflect back on moments. You know, mm-hmm. he thinks back when he was holding her up by the waist and how much he liked it. And then she thinks back on the dress and the hug.
I want to bang their heads together. Yeah, I agree with you. JK had to have this chapter open.
It's definitely done on purpose.
She had that chapter open and she was like, okay, how much can I fit in that's the exact parallel?
I love it. I think it's great. I also just want to point out that the epigraph for chapter 40 in Career of Evil says, love is like a gun, and in the hands of someone like you, I think it'd kill. It's about love.
It is about love. It's interesting that that's such a sort of, it's an epigraph about murder, whereas the epigraph for Robin and Troubled Blood is about healing and medicine, right? So that's a neat sort of comparison as to how far they've come mm-hmm. and what stage in their relationship they are at this point.
Yeah, because I'd say in Career of Evil that this is like him saying, this is dangerous.
Yes. And now she's like, this relationship could be, well, she's not like this, but we are right. like,
we,
this relationship yes. is healing and good for them. So if this is Robin's chapter 40, we know that Strike actually acknowledged that he did want to be with Robin very shortly after this.
Right. You're talking about the prologue of Lethal White.
Yeah. The prologue at Lethal White. The time was just weeks, right?
So it's coming is what you're saying.
I'm saying that maybe it's coming in the beginning of book six, if we're getting a parallel. Maybe there's a little bit of a prologue. Maybe that prologue is the Ritz.
How does he say it? Strike was forced to recognize how long and how deeply he had hoped that Robin would not marry. He had wanted her free, free to be what they had been together, free so that if circumstances changed, so the possibility was there, free so that one day they might find out what else they could be to each other.
Oh my God, first of all, oh my God.
Yes, I want this in the beginning.
Maybe that realization was the killing realization, the gun. That was the start of a year of estrangement. Maybe this parallel realization on Robin's part is going to be the healing one that starts something new.
Yeah.
I'm just saying that it's a possibility.
I'm here for it. Let's go to Robin in her hotel room with her notes and her tarot cards.
Yes, and we get into the case.
Yeah, well, before we do this, J.K. Rowling cracked me up at this part when she talks about this town hall. She called it spectacularly ugly.
Tell us how you really feel.
I looked it up. It's just a building to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I didn't think it was that ugly. I mean, the clashing colors of the brick and the stone mm-hmm. were a bit much, but...
Oh, it's funny. Did either of you guys take anything from the drawing, Talbot's drawing?
I looked through and I found a few things that stuck out at me. The one thing, it said at some bit on it, he'd written salva et coagula. No resolution without breaking down. So one, Jo has that tattooed on her wrist,
mm-hmm.
that phrase salva et coagula. And it means to break down and to bring together, I think. It's sort of that when the Hogwarts professor writes about literary alchemy, he talks yeah. about this a lot, and it's sort of that relevant to the novel about breaking something down to get at its essence, you know?
Yeah.
It's just neat that she referenced it. It feels like a little Easter egg. I noticed that it talks about poison a lot on this page. He says, lust Babylon, yet of their own poison do they perish. And then this poison is the poison of the serpent. So that's a bit of a clue that his subconscious is bringing poison.
Yeah. I loved this line that yeah. says... And then an odd idea came to Robin. The notion of a 14-sign zodiac was clearly ludicrous. But why was it more ludicrous than a 12-sign zodiac? asked a voice in her head, which sounded remarkably like Strike's.
Yeah, that's very much your voice, too, isn't it, Linz?
Which is why I liked it so much. It's so funny to me.
and then Strike calls her. It's really cute.
I love this phone call. I mean, he puts forth the effort, like you said in the last episode, Pools, about telling her when he's grateful.
Yeah.
He says, you're owed a long stretch off for this, Robin, said Strike gruffly. I can't thank you enough. Don't be silly, she said.
I like the way he always knows instantly that she has something yes. to tell him. He can always tell by the look on her face or the sound of her voice.
She literally just said, hi.
Hi. And she said it in such a way that he knew she was dying. Yeah. She had just found out something and was excited.
Yeah, and he could have easily just texted her that he was coming home Tuesday, but you know.
That pesky need.
Yeah, about hearing her voice, right?
Well, you know, he likes her face. He likes her voice. He likes being around her. Oh, this kills me. And then we get to the tarot readings. And I love it.
There are four cards here. Yes. Before the actual three card spread that she does, when they're on the phone, it says that she removed the three of discs from beneath her and examined it absentmindedly.
Yeah.
Now there's got to be a reason that J.K. Rowling put this card in there specifically.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually have my, I'm going to open them up here.
I have my tarot cards too.
Well, I have the actual
Thoth. Yeah.
So let me pull these four cards here. I have to say this is purely for research purposes because
yeah,
obviously.
I want to state here that I don't think the cards are magic or psychic. I view them as sort of just, they're like Rorschach blots. You put them on the table and you read into them what you want to read or what your subconscious wants to read. You interpret the symbolism in a way that reflects on your own life. And it's sort of a way of externalizing your thoughts and ordering them and realizing what you're thinking.
Or it's a way to predict what's going to happen in the next book, which is.
Well, yes.
That too.
These cards are psychic because the author is literally writing right. the correct yeah. ones into existence.
So this one is the Three of Discs, but it's also called the Works card. Yeah. Let's see ours together.
Yeah, mine's...
They look very different.
Yeah, they do. Well, the Thoth is coming up with a bunch of nonsense. I don't know the Thoth deck because...
Because this one is nonsense.
Yes, this one isn't nonsense. This one is okay. Legit. Okay. The Rider Waite is legit.
What do you think is the reason that she pulled this out from under her, that this card comes up? Because there is got to be a reason.
I would say that the Three of Pentacles usually symbolizes teamwork for me. It would mean coming together to create or produce something in the material realm of career or sort of finance. That it was under her and that she was examining it. I think that it's apropos to Robin's partnership with Strike and the way that it supports her. She's literally sitting on it. I think that it appears here to sort of connect with the reading she does, because it's not part of the reading, but it's close to it. And when I see discs and cups in the same reading, those two suits strengthen each other. Because I can see your face, Lindsay. I can see your Strike face, and it's so skeptical and so ridiculous. So I'm not even looking anymore.
I am just going to hide my face. I'm just listening too.
So Earth, Pentacles are Earth, and the Cups are Water, and Earth and Water strengthen each other and support each other rather than weakening or being neutral. So I would say that her partnership with Strike and all of these emotions that are going to come out in the next reading are actually supporting and working together rather than possibly causing problems. And then the Mars and Capricorn bit. Mm-hmm. She says that it represents Mars and Capricorn specifically. So when Mars is in Capricorn, this period is excellent for taking on big tasks and seeing them all the way through to the finish. So, I mean, that's what they're doing. They're taking on the big task of finding out what happened to Margot. And it's going to take them a year, but they're going to see it all the way through to the finish. They're working hard and they're going to succeed because of their partnership. That's what I'm reading.
I love it.
Thank you. You hate it.
No, I don't. I love it.
All right. And then can I just go ahead and talk about the rest of the reading?
Yes,
please do.
So I feel like when you look at the meaning of the Thoth cards, the one that Robin uses, I think that reading is pointing her towards Janice. I do. So when we go through the cards, problem is the Prince of Cups. So the Prince of Cups, Robin reads out a bit from the Book of Thoth, which I think is supposed to clue us into the meaning. The moral characteristics of the person pictured in this card are subtlety, secret violence, and craft. He's intensely secret, an artist in all his ways. I feel like that's referring to the problem, Janice, the murderer. Mm-hmm. And this case is difficult because she's so secretive and because she's so good at killing. Yeah.
She's so good at killing.
She's an artist, a murder. Yeah. So the problem is Janice. The cause of the problem is the Four of Cups. And it says the card refers to the moon in Cancer, which is her own house. But Cancer itself is so placed that this implies a certain weakness, an abandonment to desire. So I think that this refers to Janice's motivations. So not only is it referencing Cancer, which is, as we know, Janice's sign, but it's referring to her sort of corrupted desire. So when I look at the Thoth card that you have there, it looks like beautiful golden cups, right? But I think there's a sinister element to it. The backdrop behind the cups is really gray, and the handles on the cups sort of remind me of devil horns. A little. So I think that there's that sort of glamour hiding something darker. And that's what Janice is, right? Her glamour is the sort of nurturing, protective, motherly character. And it's hiding the dark, corrupted desire in her and her sort of possessive love for Duthwaite that led to Margot's death. It's a bit of a reach, maybe. But I think that the motivations behind Janice's killing could be read in the Four of Cups. And then the solution, the Two of Cups, it signifies harmony between male and female, right? The perfect balance, lover, partnership, soulmates. And I think it's obviously referring to Strike and Robin, right? But I think that in combination with that Three of Pentacles, it's talking more about their partnership that's going to be able to solve the problem. And then it said Venus and Cancer. This was just nice. Venus is the planet of sensitivity and affection. Cancer is the most nurturing. When these two signs get together, it creates a potential for greater intimacy and the chance to build up our romantic relationships. So that's how I think the reading symbolizes the actual murder she's in Leamington Spa trying to solve, right? Mm-hmm. And then you've got this sort of symbolic connection of cups and water to poison. I don't know if it's a real symbol, but it feels suggestive to me. Janice tries to poison Strike with a teacup.
Right.
Lindsay just nodding like, this is all nonsense. This is all ridiculous.
No, sorry.
But the point is, she chose these cards particularly for their symbolism, what it says to the story, right? All right, time to get on to chapter 46.
Robin's still in Lamington Spa, and she visits the Royal Pump Rooms and eventually finds Paul Satchwell.
I keep feeling the urge to pronounce it like chisel.
Yeah, I know.
Like satchel. But is it Satchwell?
It's Satchwell.
How about you pronounce it Satchwell and I pronounce it Satchel, so that either way we're correct as a group.
See, this is Paula's fault, because in one of the earlier episodes she said, I keep wanting to say Satchel like chisel. And ever since she said that, I can't stop thinking about it.
It's natural to me after the chisels. So I'm just going to say what comes natural. I might switch between them just to keep it spicy.
Spicy. The audiobook says Satchwell, so that's what I go with.
Okay. Well, the audiobook also said Isla.
But that was corrected, for me at least.
Okay,
fair enough. Yeah, mine is still incorrect. It makes me so sad.
Aw. All right, I'll try to say Satchwell. I can take the epigraph for this one, if you'd like.
Go for it.
Whereas that pagan proud himself did rest in secret shadow by a fountain side, even he it was that erst would have suppressed fair Una. Interpretations?
The first part I feel like is maybe about finding Satchwell in Lamington Spa, because the by fountain side is a reference to the town, and in secret shadow maybe that it was unexpected. She didn't expect to find him.
He does enter onto the scene by saying, it's nice to see a bit of pagan, isn't it?
Yeah.
He does literally say that. So yeah, and he's a bit of a villain.
Yeah, but the second part is what I find the most interesting, because if Una is Margot, and when I see Una, I don't mean Una Kennedy in Troubled Blood, I mean Una from the Fairy Queen. If she's Margot in this reference here, it was he that first, or so long ago, suppressed fair Una. We know that Paul Satchwell was her first love, and he was also terribly abusive.
Yes.
So that's kind of what I get from that.
I agree with you. I feel bad that Robin had a bad night's sleep, punctuated with anxious dreams. Yeah, I feel you, Robin. It's all that caffeine.
It's all that caffeine, and I get that when I have to wake up and be somewhere.
Yeah, you're too anxious to sleep.
And then you dream about it. You dream that you're running late or something, so
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Do you guys have any thoughts on Paul Satchwell's art?
Ugh.
That it's gross.
We have Persephone and Hades, Andromeda.
He's painting myths over and over that just speak to what he finds hot. And I think he's gross.
He's
gross. Except there is Leda in the Swan.
Yeah, I was just going to say, the Lady in the Swan thing is probably
foreshadowing. I think that the individual myths he's depicting here aren't as important as the association of this guy with Greek mythology. And I think that is important. But I'm going to save it because I've got a whole thing that's going to blow your minds. And I'm going to come back to it at the end so that, you can really sit with it.
When Robin finds out that he is in town and she's so excited, it's so cute how excited she is about it. She wonders if she should stay in Lamington Spa to try and find him. She knows she can't call Strike and ask him. But it's just funny to me because I think that Strike would be just as excited as she is and be like, yes, stay.
He totally would be. He would totally tell her to stay. I feel like he would have loved to have the excuse to run away from the shit happening in St. Maw's and have a little crime solving spa day vacation with Robin. Maybe they could go get a facial after they question.
Oh, yeah.
I guess it's not that kind of spa town, is it? No, I'm just thinking massages and facials. I'm back in Greece again. But no, he absolutely would have told her to stay.
Yeah. And the funeral thing comes up again. I know we talked about this last episode, but I have a little bit more to say.
Sure.
And when I say the funeral thing, I mean the fact that Robin mentions that she's been to two funerals and forgets Matthew's mother.
Ouch. Sorry, Mrs. Cunliffe. I guess
not really.
It was so unimportant. It just slipped right out of her mind. She even thinks of Matthew in her memories of this first funeral.
The first funeral is her grandfather. It was right after her attack, and she remembered Matthew's hand around hers. He had it once dropped it, skipping lectures and an important rugby game to come and be with her.
Oh, wow. He skipped an important rugby game.
Oh, man. He's what a sacrifice.
Such a hero. Wow. That just earned him a lifetime of get out of jail free card. Sorry, I cannot get over that important rugby game. I can't.
My point is that the first one, she's clinging to Matthew. And the second funeral that she thinks about is Rochelle's funeral, where it says, Robin realized that even then, the ties binding her to Matthew had been loosening. Robin hadn't yet realized it, but she found something she wanted more than she'd wanted to be Matthew's wife. So I guess my point is just the contrast with these two funerals, where the first one, she's still clinging to Matthew, and the second one, she's starting to let go and realize that she wants more.
This is why I think J.K. Rowling should go back and write the third funeral bit and insert it in like she did in Cuckoo's Calling, because that's more parallel. It's the funeral that was really important to Matthew that she almost missed because she wanted to drive Strike down to Devon and save his life and become his partner for real. So I feel like she really should go back and write that funeral in. I'm shocked that she missed that because it follows that trajectory so well. Fingers crossed for a future edition.
Then Paul Satchel does approach Robin. And it's,
yes.
It's hilarious that he has the same style, right? His shirt unbuttoned, his long hair.
God above.
Well, you know, people don't change unless they're exceptional. Then he agrees to go to lunch and talk about Marco.
Yeah, there really isn't much more to this chapter than that.
No.
But it all comes back to Greece, though.
Yes. Okay. So let me tell you the story about how I came to this theory, because I'm really excited about it. And I came up with it just a few days ago, so it's not fully fleshed out yet, but I think I'm really onto something. So I noticed in my read-through of this book that we have Paul Satchel, his left eye, he had cataract surgery on it. And it's covered with an eye patch, right? But then I realized that there's another dude with an eye injury in this book, Creed. It is specifically mentions how his eye was almost gouged out by another inmate, and he has a big scar over his left eye. So then I was like, that and the association of Satchel with Greece was like, they're cyclopses. Mm-hmm. That must be deliberate, right?
I remember you bringing this up a long time ago, but we never came up with a conclusion.
I couldn't figure out what it meant, but I was just rereading this and I had a brainwave. And my brainwave is that Troubled Blood is basically a retelling for both Corman and Robin of the Odyssey throughout the entire book. The Odyssey being the epic poem by Homer. So in the body of the poem, it takes place after the Trojan War and Odysseus is traveling home to his wife, or at least trying to. He gets into a lot of trouble on the way and is delayed by many years. Odysseus recounts a series of adventures and dangers that he faced in his journey home. And what I'm saying is that Corman and Robin both face symbolic versions of these same dangers in this book. And they're not in the same order, but I am really sure that they're all there. And to prove this, I'm going to list them.
Go for it.
So I'm going to start with the ones that I have a really strong case for, and then I'm going to move to the ones I'm not quite sure about. But so the first one, the Cyclopes. So the Cyclopes were giants with one eye. Polyphemus is one of those. He's a cannibal who traps Odysseus and his sailors in a cave and starts eating them. And Odysseus tricks him with cleverness to escape. So in the book, both Corman and Robin interview a Cyclops and trick them to sort of get information of him, and they best a Cyclops with their minds and their cleverness. And with Satchel in this chapter, he curses Robin at the end, which is reminiscent of the way Polyphemus actually curses Odysseus as Odysseus escapes.
And let me just say, when you say they both best the Cyclops, you mean Robin with Satchel and Strike with Creed.
Yes, and Strike with Creed. They best their respective Cyclops. Mm-hmm. And I feel like making them so obviously Cyclops and tying Satchel so obviously to Greece is a sort of pointer the way into the Odyssey here. And then for the rest, I'm kind of extrapolating a little. Odysseus also runs afoul of the witch Circe, who is treacherous, seductive, and she drugs food and wine to trap men and turn them into swine. Drugging food, treacherous, seductive,
poisoning.
It's the murderer. Janus. Circe is Janus, the poisoner and the deceiver. Where Circe is seductive sexually, Janus is hoodwinking with femininity of a more nurturing and kind nature. She's pretending to be of that sort of deceptive femininity. And Corman is also taken in by her act for a full year, which is the length of time Odysseus is sort of stuck there. But he ultimately bests her, just like Odysseus leaves Circe or wins him over her. I'll be real, I haven't read the Odyssey in full in a very long time. I'm sort of going off my memories and skimming the relevant bits. So, but anyway, Circe is Janus, and they both best Janus, really. Although that's mostly Cormoran's victory. And then we have the sirens. So in the Odyssey, the sirens were these beautiful, dangerous women who lure sailors to death with their songs. I feel like they're the most famous ones, right? Mm-hmm. Odysseus has his sailors plug their ears with wax and they tie him to the mast so that he can hear the siren song without jumping in and drowning. The most obvious here, Charlotte constantly reaching out and texting Strike, and Strike having to resist the urge to get drawn back into her shit, having to delete her naked selfie, having to not answer her texts. So Charlotte is a very obvious siren. We could also state that Morris is Robin's siren, except Robin isn't tempted by him at all. I guess she has her beeswax in, but it's more like she doesn't need the beeswax because she sees right through his shit, right? But he also sends a nude. He's trying to tempt her. Trying and failing. And now here's the interesting bit that I read, that some post-Homeric authors state that the sirens were fated to die if someone heard their singing and escaped them, and that after Odysseus passed by, they therefore flung themselves into the water and perished. Charlotte's suicide, right?
Yeah.
That's exactly it. He's attempted. Resisting her and she's, well, attempted.
That doesn't bode well for Morris in the future either.
Yeah, I have another interpretation for Morris that could come later, but we'll see. Other things he faced that he did, Odysseus summoned the spirit of the prophet and spoke to the dead to find out how he could get home. This whole book is speaking to the dead, Talbot's book, and to Margot. And they have to consult these ghosts to get the answer, like Talbot's astrology and tarot stuff, the fact that Margot didn't like the nurse. The answers are there and they have to find them. And Robin's the one who really loves diving into this stuff. And she's the one that's actually consulting with the dead the most. And I like that because she's tackling all of these things just as he is. They're both on this odyssey together, right? So then in the Odyssey, you have a storm, shipwrecks Odysseus, and he washes up onto the place where we find him at the beginning of the poem. Cormoran literally got stopped by a storm and had to wade through it to reach his aunt after his ship bracket car,
which is where he was in the beginning of the book.
Exactly. And this whole book is a journey through storms and waters. Anyway, at the end of the Odyssey, Odysseus returns home and he kills Penelope's, his wife's, suitors. So I'm wondering if Morris is doing double duty here, or if Morris only symbolizes the unwanted suitor. Penelope's suitors were incredibly disrespectful. They were eating up all of the estate's food. They were trying to get her to marry one of them. They were being really disrespectful jerks. So anyway, in the end of the poem, Odysseus returns home and kills her suitors. If Morris is a suitor, both Robin and Cormoran absolutely murder him, figuratively. After this murder, broken nose, stabbed foot, summary firing, Penelope recognizes Odysseus. She doesn't recognize him at first. She doesn't believe it's him. But he tells her something that only the two of them know, which in the poem is, he carved his bed out of a living tree and he built the house around it so his bed can't be moved. Just like, and this I know is a bit of a stretch, but this is just like the way Cormoran uses his inside jokes and knowledge about Robin to make Robin's birthday wonderful so that she recognizes that he cares about her and values her. And the reason this is important is because Robin hugs and kisses him just like Penelope does. So I'm going to read this little bit from the Odyssey. I forget which translation this is. I should have made a note, but it was a nice translation. So this bit after Penelope recognizes Odysseus because of something only the two of them could know, their secret. As she heard it told, her knees grew tremulous and weak. Her heart failed her. With eyes brimming tears, she ran to him, throwing her arms around his neck and kissed him. So one, I just think that's lovely. And two, I am getting shades of Robin deliberately kissing Cormoran's cheek surrounded by flowers outside of Liberty.
Yeah.
I'm just feeling that. Okay, so then there are two other sort of things that happen, dangers they face that I'm less sure about, but that I have some theories. And the first one is the sea monster Scylla. So in the Odyssey, Odysseus and his crew navigate through a narrow channel of water. And on one side is the whirlpool Charybdis. It's a dangerous whirlpool that's actually a monster. And then on the other side is the monster Scylla. Anyway, in this form, Scylla would attack the ships of passing sailors, seizing one of the crew with each of her heads. So this sort of, the sea monster Scylla, it's a metaphor for being forced to choose between two dangerous situations. I think that, and this might be a bit of a stretch, but I think that chapter 57 is the encounter with Scylla. Because you have the whirlpool, Rokeby, trying to suck you in on one side. Monster Scylla, Oakden, on the other, trying to ruin your business for his own benefit. And they're in close physical proximity, and Carmen and Robin are trying to navigate between the two. And it's the physical proximity of these two things that are causing the tension. And also, I should note that Robin is the one who gets them out of there, even though her face is a bit of a casualty, just like the six sailors, right? And then the last one that I couldn't really place is the Lotus Eaters. The Lotus Eaters is famous because it's a poem by Alfred Lord Tennyson. But in the Odyssey, they're sort of people who eat lotuses and are apathetic and forgetful because they're basically drugged. So the quote from the poem is, "They started at once and went about among the lotus eaters, who did them no hurt, but gave them to eat of the lotus, which was so delicious that those who ate it left off caring about home and did not even want to go back and say what had happened to them, but were for staying and munching lotus with the lotus eaters without thinking further of their return." So I was thinking my best guess for the lotus eaters was Roy and Cynthia Phipps, and how they were determined not to mention Margot, not to seek out what happened to her, to sort of forget about her. And Corman and Robin have to sort of overcome this reticence. I mean, Rory is basically dry kicking and screaming into talking about Margot. Mm-hmm. So that was my best guess for the Lotus Eaters. It's sort of my weakest one. So if I'm missing something really obvious. But the fact that every other adventure Odysseus faces is in this book in some form, I think that Corman and Robin are on parallel odysseys here. So I have a purpose to all this. Okay, I have some takeaways here. So first of all, first and most importantly, the Odyssey is Odysseus's journey home to his wife. Robin and Carmen to his wife. Robin and Carmen are both making this journey to get to each other because they're married or will be. They love each other. So they're making this journey and the end result is each other. And this one, it's one you might disagree with, but at the end of the poem, after the kiss I quoted above, Odysseus and Penelope retire to their bed for some lovemaking. And yes, that's actually written in the poem. So they came into that bed so steadfast, loved of old, opening glad arms to one another. I'm just saying, could this be a clue to what happens in book six? Could it be?
I hope so. After the race,
I hope so. But at some point, it's happening. Their journey to each other is almost finished, is what I'm saying.
You know what that reminds me of is the quote earlier on in the book that says something about Strike waiting for Robin at Journey's End.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, from chapter 3.
Yep.
I don't remember that.
Yeah.
It's when Robin smiles to herself about driving.
Oh my God, yes.
And yeah, thinking about him waiting for her. Yeah.
That fits. It makes sense. It's all connecting all the dots here. So I had other takeaways. Robin is the real badass of the story, is my other takeaway. She sees through her siren. She saves them from Scylla and the Whirlpool. She conquers all the other challenges just like Strike does because she is a hero and they are partners. And then also, all of the water in the book, the Odyssey is an ocean journey, right?
Right.
It's water, water everywhere. So that's sort of what I was piecing together. And I'm like, does it make sense? Yes.
Yeah.
I think it does. I think it's interesting.
You're blowing my mind.
And we know that she references a lot of Greek myths in this book. So why not retell the Odyssey in this book that's a sort of journey to each other?
It's good.
I really like it. And I think it's fun.
Hell yeah. That was awesome.
Thank you. Whew, is that it?
I think it is.
That was a long time for two chapters, one of which is incredibly short and in which not much happens.
But I'm looking forward to the next episode because Robin just kills it in her interview with Satchel. It's going to be fun.
She kicks ass and takes names.
She bests the Cyclops.
Yeah, I love that theory. That was great. Well, that is going to be it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back in another 2 weeks for a discussion of chapters 47 through 49. If you enjoy what you've heard so far, don't forget to follow us on social media. We're on Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr at the SE Files Pod with regular updates announcing future episodes. If you'd like to send us a response to anything you've heard or have something you'd like us to discuss on the show, you can always email us at sefilespodcast@gmail.com. Thank you so much again for listening, and we hope to catch you next time for another episode of the Strike and Ellicott Files.